This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll learn about a family raising grass-fed beef for six generations.
This time of year, I'll rotate them every 4 to 5 days, maybe even a week, depending on the size of the pasture, because the grass is almost done growing, but we just want them to kind of lop the heads off rather than eat the whole plant.
Also, the California Cadet Corps teaches leadership skills at Camp San Luis.
We have a philosophy that exposure equals aspirations. Young people can't know what to aspire to unless they've been exposed to it.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 26th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with playing with food. Today, the focus is on a local cattlewoman, part of a family been raising grass-fed beef for six generations. She's introduced the Playing with Food team to the picanha cut. We'll learn a bit about picanha versus tri-tip, and also about local sustainable beef production.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm Playing with Food.
You can have a great beef dinner in no time at all. Well, almost no time at all. Beef. It's what's for dinner.
Remember that commercial from the 90s? The slogan is actually still going as advertising by the Beef Industry Council. The average American eats almost 60 pounds of beef per year, surpassed only by the almost 100 pounds of chicken we eat. Pork isn't far behind at just over 50 pounds. That's according to Statista. And according to the California Beef Council, California ranks number 4 in the nation for cattle and calves and number 1 for dairy production. The Central Coast used to have a lot more cattle, and we still have a significant number. And a sixth-generation cattlewoman is grass-feeding and free-ranging cattle in Pismo Beach, Morro Bay, Harmony, and where she and I met in Cayucas.
I'm Fallon Molnar, and I am the manager of Molnar Cattle LLC. We are a sixth-generation cattle ranching family that got here in 1870. We started specializing in Angus. We were the first ones here on the coast. It used to be all Herefords. So we've been doing that for, well, about 60 or so years now. And now we have about 250 cow-calf pairs, about just over 200 heifers to breed for like a commercial stock to make mother cows out of. And then I manage the beef sales, the local grass-fed beef sales.
Start with the raising then. You said you have cow-calf pairs, and what are those for?
We keep the mother cows as long as they will keep getting bred. The calves are born in the fall. They are raised all the way up through the end of spring, and then before I started this beef company in 2020, we used to sell them on a video auction, and places like Walmart would buy them. So Walmart has other producers that have bigger ranches in other states that have a lot of grass, and so those producers will buy them. Then feedlots will buy them from those producers, and Walmart will buy the beef for Walmart. So that's what we've been doing the last 2 years. But right now I keep about 40 male steers for myself to raise on our own ranches and slaughter for our own beef.
Cow-calf pairs, so that means you have 250 calves to sell.
So we just have them for the first 9 to 10 months, and then whoever buys them keeps them until they're almost 2 years old, and then they get slaughtered.
How do you fatten your calves?
On the grass. Generally, ours are a little older than 2 years because we let them fatten naturally on grass. But this time of year, it's perfect, and the meat marbles super well because the grass has natural seeds in it, so it's kind of like a natural way of being grain-fed. But the fat's just a little bit different. It's a little more yellow color still, but it's still amazing, and the meat's pretty tender this time of year.
So what's the difference between grain-fed and grass-fed? You know, you look at these labels, and I kind of know the difference when it comes to, like, butter and milk because it makes it taste different. But for beef, I'm picturing the beef that I buy in my mind, it says grass-fed, but you're saying grain-fed gets them fatter.
Yes, grain-fed does, and that's the conventional way that most beef in, like, restaurants and throughout stores is sold. And it just makes it so much easier to fatten up the animal quicker and to feed the world. So that's kind of where it came from historically. But now people are kind of finding out that grass-fed is slightly more, a little healthier for you because there's a couple more vitamins and minerals in it. But it's really just the amount of visible fat on the meat. There's more when it's grain-fed. But a lot of people, like nowadays, doctors are saying people are supposed to cut down on red meat because of the fat on there. But when really it's not this kind of fat that's giving people cholesterol. the actual nutrients isn't that much different. I actually did my senior project on it, and the only real difference that's significant enough to even document was that grass-fed had slightly more omega-3s. But if you were worried about your daily dose of omega-3s, you could just eat a square inch of salmon, and it would be way more than beef would have anyway. So it wasn't really that significant. So it's pretty much just the visible fat. And the flavor is a little different. Grass-fed has a little more beefy flavor. Generally, you get more protein per pound since there is less fat on the steaks. But it's pretty much just buyer preference. All beef is good beef.
Is that really true?
It is, yeah.
Okay, because my stepfather, God rest his soul, we would get a really old cow, or we'd get one that broke its leg or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then he would take it to... He took it to the magic place, and it came back in wrapped packages that went into the freezer in the basement.
Yeah.
And my sister, she just thought the hamburger was gross and everything was gross because it was old cow. I mean, is that really true?
Well, as far as flavoring, yes. There is some beef that can be tougher, and some breeds, like the breeds out there that has the horns, those are a different breed called Coriennes, and those are kind of like a mixture of a couple different breeds that I don't remember the name of. But that kind of stuff is what gets slaughtered and sold to McDonald's or the older cows, because grinding is very general. Because you can grind it just about anything, add fat to it, and it'll taste good because it's ground up. Like, all beef is good beef health-wise. The flavor, that's a little different.
So my sister was kind of making it up.
A little bit. As far as ground beef, yeah, but there are some cuts that you don't want to, like, grill. Like, if you take a roast and you cut roasts into steaks, there's, like, barely any fat in them, and they're just a highly used muscle, so they're very tough, and so that's why we put them in the crock pot. Ground beef generally is pretty similar. There's some times when it's not ground good enough and there's, like, an extra thick piece or something, but that's just the processing.
Well, next time she brings it up, I'll let her know that it was all in her imagination. We did have a lot of pot roast, though.
The pot roast, those are pretty good. You really almost can't go wrong with a good pot roast. Throw it in there for 12 hours and let it cook in the broth.
So now that I've thrown my sister under the bus on the radio, I'll remind you that you're listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian with cattlewoman Fallon Molnar, talking about raising cattle, and we're just about to talk about the coveted California commodity, water. So how difficult is it to raise cattle in an area that doesn't get any rain? You're grazing your cattle on the fields which are already turning gold. So how does that work?
Well, these 2 years are actually the rain that we're supposed to have. And so we're hoping that that'll be the case, but you never know. So in the past years that we have had to worry about the drought, we have had to supplement with alfalfa hay in the fall. And we even did this last year with all the rain we had, because our cows just have nutrient needs that we like to meet, and we want them to have enough milk to feed their calves. Because like right now, it all still has its seed, at least here on the Central Coast. Like, it's still a little green, and even where it is yellow, it still has the seed on it. But when it turns in the late summer, it turns that yellow. And if there's any moisture, like a heavy, heavy fog or like a light rain in November or something, it gets a little moldy. That's where the gray color comes from. And so that gray color is like little tiny dots of gray mold, and it will break down the grass, so there's no more nutrient value in it. And so that's why we have to feed them hay. But usually on a drought year, we've had to feed hay for 6 months one time, and not to all the cows, but to our younger ones that need more help as far as protein. But this year, we had one ranch that we only fed for 3 weeks, and that was the least we've ever fed in my whole life. I'll be 26 next week. That was the best feed year we've had. Usually it's 4 to 5 on average.
What's the cost of alfalfa hay, and where does it come from?
When I started and I was showing in a 4-H and FFA, alfalfa used to be like $12 a bale, and a bale we'll feed like 5 to 6 cows per day. And a bale was $12. Now, last year, the year after COVID, they were $32 a bale. But this year they were about $26, and that's buying in bulk. We would feed 32 bales a day for the duration of the feeding season, which was this year was about 3 months. The coast has a little bit more nutrient dense grass, especially it just holds longer here because we get a little more rain. And so we like to keep the pears here on the coast just to get that nutrients.
Your cows are far apart from one another.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm looking at these cows, which you say aren't yours, like, those two cows, quote unquote, next to each other are, like, I don't know, 100 feet?
Yeah, probably so. This time of day, they like to range out and graze for themselves, and then in the morning, before they get up to eat, they will kind of clump together. So they kind of graze daylight to about 11, then they take a nap until like 2 o'clock, and then right at 2 o'clock or 3, they'll get up and graze until dusk, and then they'll go to bed for the night. But I mean, sometimes they graze through the night. We kind of pride ourselves on our regenerative program, which is what we do with these cows up the road here. That property is big enough to where we have 7 different pastures that we've set up with hot wire. It's just a more simple fence. So they listen to that one. It's just one wire that's strung with rebar with little tiny plastic insulators on it. And it's run for 7 fields, and we rotate them at different times of the year because that ranch is big enough where cows wouldn't get bred. Cows wouldn't be able to get enough grass and eat the grass evenly if we didn't do that, if we just turned them loose on the 1,200 acres. So they have about 200 acre pastures around. Some of them are like 150 that they get rotated between. And so like this time of year, I'll rotate them every 4 to 5 days, maybe even a week, depending on the size of the pasture, because the grass is almost done growing, but we just want them to kind of lop the heads off rather than eat the whole plant. Whereas like in the fall, when the grass is already dead, we'll leave them for up to 2 weeks because we just kind of want them to get all the dead stuff off the top to make room for that new grass to grow in the winter. And while the grass is growing, like around January, we'll rotate them every 2 to 3 days because we don't want them to eat it down too low, so there's nothing to grab sunlight.
Okay, are they social animals?
They are, yeah. They do like to hang in herds, and if they get by themselves, they get kind of nervous. They can see each other, especially their calves. The moms, they like to see their calves. When they're really young, though, the moms will actually hide their calves and make them stay there all day long, and then they'll come back and feed them once a day. And they're very curious, too. I was actually fixing a fence at the ranch in Harmony yesterday, and they all ran up to me and were circled around me, and then the second I left, they all went up to the fence and were sniffing it. They wanted to know what I did. It's pretty funny. They're very curious and social.
So they have a lot of land, so I'm assuming it's free range. What's like the minimum amount of land per animal that you would want? Because this is a lot of land for the number of animals that are on it.
Here, I think it's around 10 acres per cow per year. Like I've worked on ranches in Oregon where they have perpetual pasture and they have 2 to 3 cows per acre. It's just flat fields that are green all year round because they just water it. But here we don't do any irrigating, so it's just the rainfall. And some places it's even like 15 acres per cow. It's more of having enough food for the cow for the whole year rather than the physical space it needs because it moves around so much that they don't feel contained.
With that in mind, you're leasing the land. Have you been leasing it for generations?
I guess so, yeah. My dad started over. His grandfather was the one that started the whole Angus deal here. He actually brought the first herd to Cal Poly. His parents were not in ranching, so he kind of had to pick up where his grandfather left off. So he started this all over again, and I think 35 years ago now. Yeah, we've had some of these leases since then, and some we've gained over the last few years, but most of them we've had for 30 years.
So my question is, would it be economically feasible to start a cattle ranch today in this area if you need this much land to feed them?
That's the question I get from a lot of the college kids because I go and speak at Cal Poly a lot. You kind of have to have things set up correctly or go work for somebody else that has stuff and then they slowly kind of integrate you into their program. It's a lot of upfront money and you have to have the land to make it worth it because there's a bunch of equipment involved. And if you have 5 cows, you're going to need almost the same equipment as if you had 100 cows. If you have the land to put 100 cows and buy that equipment, you can make your money back more when you sell the 100 calves rather than 5 calves. You're still going to be in debt if you buy the same equipment. There's just a lot of upfront things you need to have. Like you need to have like fencing, corrals, a horse, 4-wheelers or something to feed the hay on. You have to have a hay barn, trucks, squeeze chutes, all that kind of stuff.
Today, coincidentally, I saw this big poster of Cattlewoman of the Year.
I am actually in the Cattlewoman's. Cattlewoman's and Cattlemen's are pretty much a group that defends us on a politics standpoint.
What is it like being a woman cattle rancher? Are there any unique issues?
20, 30 years ago, it wasn't very common to hear of a woman kind of caring for a herd. Now it's pretty prevalent. As far as managing and owning cattle, there's 10% of women that do it solely by themselves. It would be nice to get more women out there because now it's kind of accepted for women to be able to physically do the work. It would be nice to get more women out and about and doing these kinds of things.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian out on a cattle ranch in Cayucas. Fallon just took me through the details of raising cattle, and now I want to know about her fledgling meat business. Tell me about the meat business.
People would come up and just chat with me about the cattle, and they were like, well, why can't we buy beef from the cows that we see on the side of Highway 1? And I'm like, you know what? You're right. And so we have the cattle to do it. Taking care of the cows is one thing. It's tough work when you are out doing it, but it's not 8 hours a day. So I figured I would start with selling ground beef, and I started doing that my last year of college. Once I got back, I launched a website and apparel, and we saved a couple steers the year before because I knew I wanted to do this. And we started selling cuts, and ever since then it's been really good. People are really supportive and they're thankful that we put in the work to do that, because it is extra work. Usually the calves would be out of your hair after 9 months, but now we have to have different pastures to put them in and gather them and, you know, make sure everything's health-wise is okay and make sure there's no foxtails in their eyes and they're not getting foot rot. There's more cows that I have to like babysit now to keep them alive and keep them well for the people. I've been running my business out of 7 chest freezers for 4 years, and now I finally got my walk-in freezer, so I finally have some space to keep some meat. I just recently, this last year, got an awesome deal with most of the schools in the county, and now I'm selling ground beef to Templeton, San Miguel, Shandon, San Luis Coastal, and Cayucas. They all have grants and they've been able to buy local beef, so all the kids are getting some really high quality meat now. So it's been really good to keep the value vertically integrated rather than letting McDonald's buy our bulls for pennies and then feed all their stores with it.
That's really great. So that's staying local. And then how do you distribute the cuts?
The cuts, I do one farmer's market year-round. That's in Morro Bay. I do online sales, which is I can ship all over the U.S. So I have like a couple, I think 6 or 7 variety boxes that I have just kind of put together. I do online sales locally. People order, give me a ribeye in New York and a tri-tip and I'll pick it up this day, you know.
The cuts of meat were not on the ranch. Well, they were in the walk-in freezer, but that wasn't very visually interesting. So to better understand the meat sales side of this entrepreneurial cattlewoman, I went to...
We are at the Cayucas Farmers Market.
What do you have with you? Let's look in your treasure trove of steaks here. What do we have?
Well, I have a whole bunch of stuff with me today for beef. I usually do like 14 general cuts, cause just because I have 14 spaces on my board to like put labels. So I have everything from ground beef to stew, to roast, to tri-tips and picanas, to steaks. I also have marrow bones as well. And then I started doing a little bit of local pork, so I have some of that too. Generally my biggest seller is just regular ground beef.
People are lazy.
Yeah, people, they like to just throw out a pan and call it good, yeah.
So what was the one that started with a P?
The picana.
This is a cut that's from...
It's a Brazilian cut.
A Brazilian cut, but it's becoming really popular in the United States right now. Can you show me one?
Yes, they are very similar to a tri-tip, but they have a big fat cap on the top. It's actually the cap of the sirloin, and so they leave it whole as a roast, and it's more tender and has more flavor than a tri-tip, but you cook it pretty much the same. And it has the muscle going one direction, you cut it crossways like you would a tri-tip. They're just, in my opinion, so good. We actually had one for Christmas this year instead of prime rib, and it was delicious.
So. Okay, so you had it instead of prime rib.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. I sold all my prime rib, but this is the next best thing in my opinion.
I'm a tri-tip lover.
That won't disappoint.
I follow steaks on Instagram.
Yeah.
And there's this steak barbecuer guy. He was talking about the picana, and I put in there, looks very delicious, but I'm from California, so it's tri-tip all the way, and he replied politely, but encouraged me to give that a try.
Yeah, I agree with him. I think it's better than tri-tip.
You know where you are, don't you?
I know where I am. Yes. And it's funny because a lot of other states, like Texas, a lot of them don't know what tri-tip is. Exactly. And so that's probably their version of tri-tip, but it is more tender because it is a steak cut. So you would cut top sirloin out of it.
This has a fat cap on it. And I learned when I was in my 20s that cooking tri-tip, if I didn't cut it off, I had a fire on my grill.
Yeah.
So should I do that with this?
No, you should leave this on. It actually enhances the flavor and the fat kind of runs down into the meat and it'll make it pretty tender. And this fat's a little different. It's like a little bit of a harder fat and it's a little slightly different color because it's grass fed. So it's not quite as jello-y as normal grain fed will.
And I can do it just like a tri-tip with my garlic, pepper, and salt and just 45 minutes.
Whatever you do with tri-tip will probably work for this.
I left with a picanha, but was skeptical. Even though I grew up bistatal, I was born on the Central Coast, and growing up, I lived in Santa Maria during barbecue season. So I'm firmly in the tri-tip camp. I invited some Midwesterners, my Bay Area-raised sister-in-law, and my brother, whose bistatal pedigree is a different mix than mine. And I barbecued the picanha and a grass-fed tri-tip.
Is this the fat cap on the top?
Yeah, so all the recipes that I saw were to make steaks out of, to sear both sides, and then to make steaks out of them, and make that little, what's a little French cookie that looks like a U and a butterfly?
Palmier?
Yeah, palmier, a little French cookie on a skewer, and then cook the steaks. Yep. All of them said that except for one that said, here's how to do it whole. And so I'm trying to do it whole because the cattlewoman said, you can cook it exactly like you cook your tri-tip.
There you go.
But then as I got closer to doing this, I thought, maybe she smokes her tri-tip.
Nah.
So what I did was, as the coals were dying down, I smoked it on the other half of the grill.
Oh, you put a little smoke on it.
And then to let the fat cap kind of start seeping in. And then hopefully now that it's on
direct heat,
when I need to turn it over, it won't turn into a fire. I don't know. We'll see. She says it won't because it's grass-fed and it's a special kind of fat.
Oh, okay.
But the tri-tip is a pound bigger than the Precania. Yeah, but they're both grass-fed. Not from the same company, but they're both grass-fed.
Oh, okay.
This one, the Precania, I didn't ask if she named it, but I'll ask her.
Grass-fed is really, really super lean compared to other tri-tips I've had.
It is super
it's
lean.
It's really super lean. It's a way different texture. But strangely enough, it's similar to the Picano.
Okay. Are we ready to dig in?
Yeah. Dig it.
Okay. Ladies first.
Okay.
Who's tried both?
I have.
Okay. What do you think?
The Picano is very, very tender. Even the thicker slices is really tender.
I've been told that it tastes beefier. Does it taste beefier?
Maybe.
I don't think so.
They're similar in taste.
They're similar in taste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a texture difference.
Yes.
Is one texture better than the other? Is tender necessarily better?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it's just a different, like the tri-tip is more rustic.
It's like bread versus toast.
Kind of, yeah.
I was outnumbered, but I still liked the tri-tip more than the Picanha. For me, it was context. Picanha maybe in the winter with indoor sides. Tri-tip to me is summer barbecue. But to each their own. I'm glad that we have local beef raised on the Central Coast. I'm even happier that it's not high stock density. I'm also glad that more women like Fallon are breaking gender barriers, and I'm super chuffed that our school kids are experiencing local produce in their school lunches. And for you listening, it's not yet 2:00, so it's not too late for...
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, correspondent Tom Wilmer reports from Camp San Luis Obispo, where he visits with Major Tate Burns, who shares insights about the California Cadet Corps. It's a program for students from 12 through 18 years old.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Camp San Luis Obispo, California, and we're here with Tate Burns with the California Cadet Corps.
That's correct.
Tate, pleasure to meet you.
You as well. Thank you for having me.
Self-confess, I know very little about the Cadet Corps other than I see them on retreats and drills on base periodically. Tell us about the history, how it started, why.
Great question. So back in 1911, the California Army National Guard realized they had a need to cultivate, develop, and train leaders for the new California Army National Guard. So in 1911, General Forbes decided to create what was then called the California High School Cadets. And it was in most every high school in California. And it became what is known across the nation as Junior ROTC, so Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps. So California was the first in 1911. It started up here in San Luis Obispo and spread throughout the state. As political climates changed, as social climates changed, it was in favor and out of favor in certain areas in California. If you look on our YouTube channel, there's film reels from Azusa High School, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. I think it was in the early 50s, cadets coming up here through train cars into the rear warehouse areas for their summer encampment, which is usually 10 days to 2 weeks. And it was run primarily like a military training program. It then became the California Cadet Corps, and quite often that would translate into cadets going into the National Guard or active duty Army or several different branches. Curriculum was refined and designed to meet the needs of the classrooms in the 60s and 70s, and it became an elective course offered in schools. Recently, maybe the last 15 to 20 years, there's something called an A through G requirement, where Cal State Universities and University of California has made a list of English, science, math, social studies electives that are categorized A through G. So the California Cadet Corps is recognized as a G elective. So students going to a Cal State University or University of California Cadet Corps is an elective that counts towards their efforts at a university. Interestingly enough, more than likely it's a high school course. It's now expanded to 4th grade through 12th grade.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we have elementary programs. We call them Grizzlies, and they're 4th and 5th graders, unless it's a K-8, like I ran a K-8 out of Chino, California. And so then they're combined with the other students up to eighth grade. We have military institutes in California, like California Military Institute in Paris, California, which is fifth grade through 12th grade. They wear uniforms every day and they go through, each student has a cadet corps class or a military science class.
Is that similar to Youth Challenge National Guard program?
Very good question. So we're up to almost 7,000 cadets in California. That includes the Challenge, Sunburst, and Grizzly programs, potentially be a pre-expulsion to a pre-adjudication program. And they do compete with us in different events and sometimes go through different things with us, depending on security risks and things like that. It does all fall under youth programs. We're extremely grateful for General Cross and Command Sergeant Major Aller with youth programs. They funnel a ton of resources and money through youth programs to California Cadet Corps and the Challenge programs, which are amazing, super successful. General Cross is super involved, really grateful for him. So it's kind of expanded from a high school program to now as low as fourth grade. We also have Oakland Military Institute in Oakland, which is middle school and high school. And then we have Porterville Military Academy that just opened, and that's in Porterville, California. Those are all dependent charter schools. They're through the local school district.
But that's not a part of National Guard.
In a way. And then we also have La Sierra Military Academy. So those military academies have been under an umbrella called the XMI. So the Ex-Military Institute Initiative started under General Gabrielli with CalGuard. And that's allotted funding for state active duty personnel, both Army National Guard and CalGuard, to serve active in helping those schools with everything from logistics to TAC NCOs, to just a ton of support, again, through General Cross and Command Sergeant Major Aller, really making sure that resources get to those larger schools, similar to how the Challenge programs would work with state active duty personnel through CalGuard and through the Army National Guard. There's even some Air National Guard assets that are allotted to those schools. So it's a tremendous resource and opportunity for students. We have a philosophy that exposure equals aspirations. Young people can't know what to aspire to unless they've been exposed to it. And something we're really, really proud of is not only revamped, modern, and relevant curriculum with over 700 lessons. So commandants, those are our adult leaders, can teach this fourth grade through 12th grade and probably never repeat a lesson. So it's engaging. It covers wellness, military subjects, personal finance, all kinds of things that are relevant to schools today. So we're really grateful for that. One of our biggest crowning capstone projects every summer is our summer encampment here at San Luis Obispo. We had just under 600 cadets this year out at the parade field in an encampment.
That's what the group of tents were all about.
Yes, yes, yes. So thankfully, again, General Cross and General Gabrielli really petitioning lawmakers and the governor and getting great funding to where we have a warehouse full of REI, so they're top quality single-person tents, sleeping bags, mats, just incredible resources and materials and a full-time staff to help us get that going. And so they go through 3 days of leadership camp, everything from a little bit of orientation to this is the program, this is how you march, and then some other battalions of more experienced cadets getting deeper leadership skills. And then they branch into an advanced encampment for about 7 days. And we have an NCO academy, an OCS, a drill instructor school, advanced drill instructor school. And we've been adding a lot of STEM activities. So we now have an engineering program where they learn the geometry and mathematics of engineering. They build a bridge. We have a drone program where they learn and potentially get their license to fly drones, which for young people is great extra money. We just added a lifeguard program in our partnership with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, where they learn all of the emergency medical components and first aid components of being a lifeguard. We have a medic program run by some amazing paramedics with Cal Fire and other agencies, where they get certified in basic emergency medicine and they can respond to injuries and burns and cuts and one small step below an EMT. So it really exposes them to the medical field. We have a law enforcement program where the National Guard opens up their law enforcement program, their shooting house, their procedures. SWAT teams come up from different agencies throughout the state and give classes, and cadets are exposed to almost like a mini police academy or a police explorer program. And they get, you know, badges for that. And there's gosh, there's an engineering, there's drone, there's cyber. And so we actually have some Army cybersecurity officers that come and teach all of the basic computer coding, cybersecurity. They even go to the computer lab at Cuesta College, and just the amazing amount of resources. And there's a basic leadership. There's field skills where they go out in the hills of San Luis Obispo on post in these different training facilities and live for 7 days and learn how to forage for food and how to properly start fires and how to camp and all these things. And then they have an advanced survivor school where they live on 800 calories a day, and they have to do different things while navigating mountains and hills and a lot of different programs that really help these young people to walk taller and taller each day and realize their potential. And it's so encouraging to watch the buildup throughout the year, but also that 10 days where as soon as they get off the bus, we take their phones away. So it's a digital detox, which is fantastic. And then they just learn to work together and they stumble through things. And we have a phrase that they're failing forward. And for young people today, it's such an invaluable lesson to fail forward.
Speaking of that, what's the attrition rate?
Summer encampment, we had just a little under 600, and because of injuries, two went home. So it's super small.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And there's a lot of tears the first couple nights. I function this year as a chaplain. I'm an ordained minister on top of being an educator. And so it was a lot of, hey, let's go for a walk. Let's talk about what you're missing. And sometimes it boils down to that digital detox. They can't live without their video games or their phones. They start to make friends. They're missing their families. And then right about the last day or the day before, we get the opposite. I don't want to go home. I've got structure here. I eat three times a day. I mean, not trying to minimize anything parents are doing, but there's so much structure and routine that they're now thriving on structure and routine. I had some young men look at me and go, man, here, I'm a sergeant. At home, I'm just someone's little brother and I get picked on. And so those are great teachable moments for, hey, how can you advocate for yourself? Or what did you like here? Oh, I love the law enforcement program. Did you know there's a neighborhood explorer program with your local police department? There's a grant to pay for you to go through that training. And so it's just great to see them, young men and women, just walk tall and advocate for themselves and get a vision for what they want to do. And some of them never thought about a career in the military or going to college or even, you know, some of these things they're doing, medic and engineering, and it's giving them vision to now think about college. It's just super encouraging to see. And there's about 100 adults that help out through that process, and they all get extremely exhausted.
What if a parent has a kid that wants to go to one of the programs, but there's none locally? What do they do?
So that's a great question. So we just got some regulations changed, and we have a reserve cadet program. So let's say a young person was in a cadet corps program at their middle school, but the high school doesn't have it, or their neighbor does it, but their school doesn't have it. And so now they can join any local program with the principal's permission, because they don't really go to that school, and it's primarily school-based, and they can be a reserve cadet and still participate in our events throughout the year and summer encampment, and it's 100% paid by the state. So when they come here, we're paying for their transportation, extra uniforms, food. Parents pay $150 for 10 days, and we feed them and clothe them and house them, and it's a bargain. It's great. But the state, we can always find ways to get a scholarship for that $150, and so it's wonderful when a parent needs a resource but can't afford one. And now it's expanding to VFW organizations may sponsor a cadet corps unit. So it's not necessarily from a school. It's a community-based effort or a community-based unit, which obviously opens the cadets up to amazing mentorship through those veterans groups.
And again, across California, there's a breadth of different places.
Correct. 7,000 cadets throughout the state, from Northern California to Southern California. Primarily in California, most of California's students live in Riverside or San Bernardino County just for the affordable housing. Most families tend to go there, but it's throughout the state. We have brigades throughout the state.
And San Francisco, Bay Area.
Oakland Military Institute's in the Bay Area. We have some units in San Francisco. We also have as far as Yosemite up north, and they, if the school can't afford transportation, again, wonderful support from the state military department. They usually are able to find a rental and pay for it so the commandant can get his kids to an event. So it just super encouraging amount of resources.
That's really cool. So the bulk of the kids are high school age, correct?
I would say the bulk are high school. It's growing in the elementary and middle, but absolutely the bulk is high school.
So postgraduate, do the kids typically matriculate to university or colleges? And do they immediately go into an ROTC program?
So our current data, and we're trying to do a lot of more modern data collection with kids graduating high school, Right now it shows us about 8 to 10% either enlist or go to a university ROTC program.
And the remainder, what happens to them?
The remainder we're tracking as far as going to a trade school, junior college, or a university, but those that go enlist, National Guard, Reserve, or CalGuard, because CalGuard has some amazing tuition reimbursement programs for some of our young people, it's about 8 to 10%. So some, and because we focus everything on leadership, the emphasis is leadership, we understand the National Guard expects a return on their investment, but they also have never said, hey, unless we get a certain percentage, we're going to cut funding. It's
right here, there's Grizzly Youth Academy, and that's part of the National Guard Youth Challenge. My wife was an instructor there for years. Little dated stats, but I was told that the number of kids that graduate from Grizzly do not exceed the statistics for kids in the regular schools as far as how many actually go into the military. You know, one of the naive outside visions is, oh, this is just an artificial recruitment mechanism. But what you're saying about California Cadet Corps, not so.
It varies, and that certainly makes sense for what the challenge programs are designed for. You'll see we purposely put them in a tan uniform. We don't want junior soldiers. The National Guard doesn't want junior soldiers. They don't want cadets being thanked for their service at the grocery store. And I appreciate how they say, no, we want them distinctly different. Mm-hmm. And all of our curriculum focuses on leadership, not so much military service, which, you know, most of us that are instructors are prior service and we share and encourage, but it's got to be the choice of that cadet. We're seeing a lot more do delayed enlistment, which is after their junior year, they go to basic training. And then during their senior year, if it's a reserve or guard unit, they report to those units and they're able to get drill pay during their senior year. We see a lot of that. And then we see a lot of students taking advantage of either reserves, CalGuard, or National Guard for tuition assistance, which is fantastic. But also, unfortunately, even though we're raising some great leaders, they're definitely entrenched and saturated in social media. And so they're afraid of military service and their families are afraid of military service because of what's going on in the world right now. And so we try really, really hard to teach them how to research reality and real news and not fall susceptible to social media, which, you know, could be farthest from real news. And so those create great discussions. But unfortunately, I think that affects some of the numbers that they're just afraid. And I think even, you know, my professional life as a teacher and as an administrator, I see a lot of young people not going into public service. I know a lot of police agencies and fire departments are having a hard time hiring young people.
Any explanation for that?
You know, I can only make assumptions. They're just not interested in the lower pay versus the higher benefit. I think a lot of them since COVID have realized there's great online employment opportunities and to work from home, and they're missing out on the social aspect. And I think that's what we try to encourage during state events and certainly at a summer encampment is socializing outside of who you text or outside of who's online. And I think that's a skill that's just not being taught at home. It's rare that they're being told to go outside and play. And so I think that really reflects more young people going into information technology or something that's home-based. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate.
It is. We're going to have to regroup, join up with you when your next sortie here.
Yeah, we'd love that.
Yeah. To learn more about your world.
Well, we have a great website, cacadets.org. It's robust. We have tons of pictures and video from our summer encampment, especially our growing marksmanship program with our partnership with SLOSA down the street, which is a private firing range. They've really dug in and helped instruct a very safe and effective marksmanship program for, you know, a lot of parents and schools are very anti-weapons, anti-guns. And through a grant through the NRA, we're able to purchase weapons and run a super successful, super safe program, zero injuries.
When I was a kid, everybody went through the NRA, you know, safety, marksmanship, and whatnot. Does that still happen?
As a school administrator in Los Angeles, I know that that is nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. When I was at the California military.
That's kind of a shame, isn't it?
It is. It's a missed opportunity to learn responsibility and safety. And the range safety officers and our commandants that worked that program went through it when they were cadets. We have a lot of adults that were former cadets. And a lot of cadets will tell you, especially young women, that I never thought I would handle a weapon, but they just drove home safety, safety, safety. And so they feel very confident around a weapon. They understand gun ownership a lot more. They understand
gun safety.
Right. And it lends itself to life, being safe and you know, thinking ahead and planning. And so if you go to our website, cacadets.org, you will see a plethora of pictures from all different sorts of state events. And on our YouTube channel, there's a lot of cadet interviews, and you'll see young ladies being interviewed about leadership positions and young ladies going through drill instructor school and just the amazing confidence booster. And some of our cadets that you'll see interviews that have gone on to military academies and never saw that when they were young, but, you know, a free and amazing education.
You've been doing this long enough. Do you ever have any kids come back as grown-ups that went on to...
So another great question. So right now I'm running a week-long academy. It's a minimum of 60 hours, and we call it BCTA, Basic Commandant Training Academy. And for an adult to receive a commission through the state military department, that we have to go through mandatory minimums of training to teach the program and have a credential through career tech education. You have to go through this week-long academy and then take some university courses. So I have, right across the ravine, I have 10 different people right now, teachers, current state active duty that want to teach this. And so they're going through that training academy. Then we have two more training academies. So it's our version of like an OCS program. And so academic grueling. Okay. We understand that some of us are in a season in life where doing push-ups is not going to be super successful, but they're great instructors and great leaders. And so after those three phases of, you know, basically an officer candidate type program, then they can promote past O3 or past captain and take on more leadership roles.
So you're a major.
Yes, sir.
In the California cadet program.
Correct.
State Guard.
Well, we fall under the state military department. So our commission's through the state military department, and we get our pay is a daily rate. So as an O4, I get a daily rate of an O4, not with the housing allowance or anything, just the daily rate of an O4. And it's the state's way of compensating us, making sure that we're on workman's comp if we are injured, especially if we're renting vehicles to transport cadets. So we get that daily rate. Helps compensate our expenses to get to different events and pay for billeting and stuff like that. So it's a nice bonus. My name is Major Tate Burns. I am the state S3 assistant. I assist in professional development and training, and I'm also an assistant chaplain here with Cadet Corps. My 9-to-5 job, I work for the Los Angeles County Office of Education as a school administrator, and I train about 50 different schools in behavior management and restorative justice, which I love.
That's really cool. Tate, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
This has been great.
Well, we'll have to do it again with some of our other adults. We have an amazing adult cadre.
Let's plan on it. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Camp San Luis Obispo, California.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. We're going to take a short break. When we return, you'll hear about a UC Santa Barbara student film uncovering forgotten history of a Chumash Island in Goleta Slough. You're listening to KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Every summer, UC Santa Barbara hosts a 9-week course where students team up to create an original documentary about the coast. One team uncovered the story of a forgotten Chumash Island in Goleta Slough. It was destroyed by the federal government in the 1940s to build the Santa Barbara Airport. Here's KCBX's Gabriela Fernandez.
Jada Pina is a UCSB student who decided to focus her documentary on the Goleta Slough. She says the film is called Koa. It's named after an island that was at the center of the slough.
It was a thriving Chumash civilization, and it was an island that had multiple resources, like 9 streams that were feeding into the slough, and food sources, and great climate.
It's now a protected wetland near the Santa Barbara County coast. According to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, different indigenous tribes used the slough as a harbor thousands of years ago when it was a major trade center. Chumash people would dock traditional redwood plank canoes called tommels to help them explore for food and other goods across the coast. According to the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, the area was the most densely populated area of the Chumash region and most likely all of California.
And it got me thinking, like, what happened to this island that was such a thriving place?
Epina says if you walk out into the slough today, you'll see a small dirt mound where koa used to exist. She says that sliver that's left is now owned by a gas company.
A lot of our filming was of that lump of dirt, or what remains of the island.
But what exactly happened to all the Chumash people who lived on that island, and why did they end up leaving? UCSB student Catherine Scanlon helped produce, write, and edit the film. She says upon researching, the team found out the area was bulldozed to make room for the Santa Barbara Airport.
Basically, they destroyed the island. Like, they bulldozed, they got rid of half the island and used that dirt to fill in the swampy, like, slough area where the airport is. So it's not even that the airport's, like, on top of the island. It's that they destroyed the island to make the airport.
According to Santa Barbara's tourism website, the airport started out as a single airstrip. Expansion came when the prospect of World War II began to escalate. The United States government created a program to build 250 airports across the country and selected this area to build what's now called the Santa Barbara Airport. Scanlon says decades after Chumash people were rounded up to work at the mission, they were still doing ceremonies in the slough when airport construction forced them to leave.
Chumash culture is still going on. It didn't all just end or get destroyed with colonization, even though there was so much death and destruction.
The team says they wanted to write about this history to remind people that the land was taken away from the Chumash and destroyed. Epina says tribes have not forgotten about it.
When we were interviewing, we felt the frustration. Their perspective really opened our eyes to being aware about land ownership.
Epina says the goal of this project is to remember the island, even for an audience that may never have heard of it.
I think it's important to recognize that it was owned by Indigenous in the past. It hasn't always been owned by these companies.
Scanlon says she hopes that after people view the documentary, they'll listen to Chumash people and learn their history.
And really hear in their own words and understand some of the things about how some sort of reconciliation or land back could happen. I think a lot of people, maybe it seems too complicated. We're not telling people the answer or like giving the solution, but we want people to start actually listening and thinking about that.
Goa and 3 other student films will premiere at the Pollock Theater in Santa Barbara. For KCBX News, I'm Gabriela Fernandez.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, everyone's heard about the wonders of California's coastal redwood trees. They can live for hundreds, even 1,000 to 2,000 years, all while enduring West Coast fires, storms, and pests. But there's an equally fascinating native California tree, the Bishop Pine. While it's not a household name, the drought-tolerant, rocky soil-loving plant has fashioned its own way of surviving the ages. Lucen Mendel of the California Report takes us on a hike.
California is home to a lot of iconic trees. We've got giant sequoias, windswept Monterey cypresses, and Joshua trees. Of course, we've also got LA's famous palm trees. The Bishop Pine doesn't have that kind of celebrity status, but if you live on the Point Reyes Peninsula in West Marin County, you're probably pretty familiar with them. These indigenous trees are so well-suited to growing here that to locals, they're notorious pests, not because of how easily they grow, but because of how they die. The California Report's Lucen Mendel takes us to Tomales Bay State Park to meet someone who's made it his mission to deal with the pesky, yet strangely lovable, pine trees.
Attention aux pieds.
That's Emmanuel Serriere. White hair, bright orange chainsaw chaps. I'm watching him remove a fallen tree from the Johnstone Trail.
That should do it. What do you think? Is that a trail again?
Yeah, it looks like a good opening. Then Emmanuel faces the cross-section of the trunk he just cut, as though he's about to count the rings. But instead, he pulls out a permanent marker.
24. 05. And the date is...
It's not uncommon to see fallen tree trunks on the sides of hiking trails, but the Johnstone Trail is the only one I know where the trunks are dated. By Emmanuel.
I walked the trail and it was blocked, so I took my saw and I unblocked it.
Emmanuel has been doing this for 14 years, clearing tree-sized messes and leaving behind neatly dated mementos. The messes made by bishop pines, though, they're only getting bigger.
Is that a bishop pine?
It's amazing. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a bishop pine. These days are numbered.
The tree we're looking at is big, at least 80 feet tall, which is tall by Johnstone Trail standards. The tree's branches are all at the top, way above us, full of bushy pine needles.
Either the whole tree falls because of a big gust of wind, or they snap in the middle at some kind of canker, like this one.
The bishop pine we're looking at has a bulge in its trunk, about 20 feet off the ground. It looks like the tree swallowed a giant pumpkin. It's actually an infection called a canker, caused by a fungus. The tree gets weaker and weaker above the canker until one day it becomes a pencil tree.
Because it looks like a pencil somebody got mad and broke in two.
We walk by many, many broken pencils, not only in the park, but also walking back to Emmanuel's house in Inverness, which borders the state park. Emmanuel points out fences and houses that had been damaged by falling bishop pines. We pass driveways with huge piles of branches and fallen litter ready for the wood chipper, all of it stoking fears of wildfires. I was beginning to see bishop pines as falling somewhere between pest and menace. Then I spoke with Emmanuel's neighbor, Tom Gaiman, who has a totally different take on bishop pines. Tom is a professional forester who's studied the Tomales Bay bishop pine forest in detail.
Some of these tall ones here are ones that I planted from seed.
He points to a dozen bishop pines outside his window. Now, one does not simply buy bishop pine seeds, or at least not if you're Tom Gaiman, super fan for the home team. First, he collects the pine cones. Even his bishop pines that are only 5 years old have little cones on them. Now, getting the seeds out, that's the challenge. Because unlike pine cones you might normally encounter, these cones are sealed shut with resin. The seeds stay locked in these closed cones until a fire melts the resin and the cones pop open.
So after a fire rolls through, it would kill the bishop pines that open their cones, and the wind blow or the heat from the fire would distribute on little helicopters the seeds.
Those seeds regenerate into trees. It's beautiful in a poetic way, but also tragic. Okay, I'll admit it. I find bishop pines hard to root for. It's like they're not even trying. They get infected and snap like pencils. Their little root balls get soggy and they fall over. Wildfire? Whoosh, they're gone.
Redwoods, on the other hand, endure fire, but they have a fibrous, thick bark.
That's what I'm talking about. Redwoods grow over 300 feet tall. They live for hundreds and sometimes 1 or 2,000 years. Whenever I've walked in a redwood forest, it's been shady and cool and tidy. It feels majestic. That's not my experience with the Johnstone Trail. It's messy. There are dead trees and branches everywhere, and dense mounds of needles.
And around here in some places, you can walk through a Bishop pine forest, and it hasn't burned for so long that the litter can be a foot deep. The seeds won't germinate on that.
The seeds need to be down on what Tom calls bare mineral soil. In 1939, a dozen years before Tomales Bay State Park opened, there was a big fire that cleared the land. The Bishop pine forest we see today naturally sprung back after that wildfire.
There might be 40 generations of Bishop pine in the life of one redwood tree. So Bishop pines are resilient in that the young ones can burst onto the landscape after a fire.
This whole time I was walking on the Johnstone Trail, looking for the rest in peace dates of fallen trees, pitying the puny pencils, I was literally missing the forest for the trees. I like that Bishop pines make space for the next generation. So with this new appreciation, I returned for a second hike with Emmanuel Serriere on the Johnstone Trail. It's foggy today, and there's dew coating the leaves.
Look at all those ferns. Look at this. This is Jurassic Park.
We walk through a corridor of luscious green ferns. We also pass cross-section after cross-section of fallen tree trunks.
Must be a date somewhere on some of the old stuff.
But some of the trunks we pass are so old, they've decomposed pretty much into mulch. And then we're at the vista. We're looking out over the Bishop Pines to Tomales Bay, glistening below us in the distance.
This is beautiful. This is so gorgeous. This is what makes me proud to clean the trail by looking at things like this.
At last, we reach the summit.
Here we are. This is the summit. 541 feet. That's the top of the trail.
The top of the trail is more of a plateau. There's no grand view of Tomales Bay here, though there are some towering old Bishop pines.
But look, we got new babies. You got new Bishop pine coming up.
Next to a fallen tree, we spot a new batch of bushy Bishop pine children.
That was our intern, Lucen Mendel, on the Johnstone Trail in Tomales Bay State Park.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.